You may know that I teach a weekly Parsha class here at Ikar in Los Angeles every Thursday at noon, Pacific time. You're welcome. We've got folks joining us virtually from places as far away as Japan on Zoom. And we've been archiving video edits of the classes on YouTube, but we thought we might try cutting down the 1 hour class to about 40 minutes for you, for the listeners of the Best Book Ever podcasts that might not be able to fit a midday class on a Thursday into your schedule. So I hope you enjoy listening to these as much as I enjoy teaching them. If you're interested to attend the class from wherever you are in the world in person, then stick around at the end of the podcast. I'll tell you how to register. Just like the podcast, it's absolutely free, and we'd love to have you. Hello, welcome. Hello and welcome. Nice to see you all. What do I have to tell you? I think I should just say a little bit about what's coming up this month, what I'm up to. I'm hosting our monthly Beit Midrash on the East Side, if you're on the East Side of Los Angeles tonight. Next week, if you're in San Francisco, next Wednesday, I'll be hosting, I don't know why I say hosting, teaching a Beit Midrash. I'm actually not hosting. Temple Beth Israel is hosting tonight, and Congregation Beth Shalom is hosting Wednesday of next week. We'll start to get it into like Passover prep starting next week. So that'll be some of the themes. And then if you happen to be in Los Gatos for Shabbat next week, I'm going to be there for Shabbat at Congregation Shir Chadash. Heading into Passover on the 25th. That's a Thursday of Chol Hamoed, the week of Passover. I'm going to be doing some poetry readings inspired by the Song of Songs, which we read on Passover at Der Nister in downtown Los Angeles. So just just FYI, and you can always sign up for my mailings where I give these updates at hadar.org /west, and that's about it. I guess the only other thing is I will put in the chat now the essay that I wrote this week for Hadar on Parshat Shmini, where I discussed the mikveh, because Parshat Shmini has in it the first appearance of something that looks like the mikveh, the ritual bath that we y have been using ever since. But I put that in the chat so that you can read it, because our class today is not going to have a lot to do with that. Sometimes I try to relate them, or sometimes I'm still thinking about the theme that I wrote about. But today we're going to look at something else entirely. Although we are in, I'll just locate us. We're in Parshat Shmini, and Parshat Shmini is Shmini means eighth, and that's because it's the eighth day. And on the eighth day after the assembly and the erection of the tabernacle, on the eighth day they inaugurated it. So Parshat Shmini is because it was the eighth day, and on the eighth day was the day of inauguration. There's something to that. Maybe we'll talk about that more next week, about the numbering and the eighth day of the inauguration, the eighth day of circumcision. There are some things there to play around with numerology, which I'll be writing about next week, and maybe we'll learn a little bit about next week. But this week, here we are in the inauguration of this a whole sacrificial system. We've been talking about it now for a couple of weeks because, we've been talking about it for longer than that, because at the end of Exodus, we begin to build the tabernacle, the Mishkan. We get the instructions for that, and we start to talk about the idea that there will be a sacrificial system in Israel. The people of Israel, And then the book of Leviticus opens up and we get more instructions now detailing the sacrifices themselves. And we've been studying about that for the last couple of weeks. Why are there sacrifices? Why a sin sacrifice or a well-being sacrifice? There are various kinds of sacrifices. And one of the things that I've been suggesting is that it's very important to keep our eye on what a particular sacrifice is for and what its history is in the earlier stories of the Torah's narrative, because we can see some of these sacrifices have been used since the days of Cain and Abel. So that's important to know what the sacrifice, the categories of sacrifices represent. But today, I want to drill down even further and begin to look at another kind of Leviticus analysis, and that is a careful look at the animals being sacrificed. Leviticus is a very, very difficult book. It's all, it reads like it's just technical ritual details that we have no understanding of and no access to. That's somehow priestly knowledge or divine knowledge, and it all seems either mysterious or irrelevant or archaic. It reads that way, but we can read carefully, and just as we've done with the categories of sacrifices, where have we seen these before? Leviticus is in the middle of the Torah, so it is related to Genesis and Exodus, though it doesn't naturally flow from Genesis and Exodus. But it is important for us to remember that this book is in the Torah, and therefore we're being asked to look at these sacrifices in light of what we've seen before. And that is even true for the animals themselves. So, you know, you may feel like this sensation of reading through Leviticus, and you've got, you know, a he-goat and a bull and a sheep, and there's four of them, and there's one, you know, it's just like, ugh, details irrelevant. Today, we're going to try to make them a little more relevant, at least in one instance. So here we go. Let's take a little pause. Let's take some breaths, and we will we'll say a blessing over our Torah study. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kidshanu mitzvotav v'tzivanu lasok b'divrei Torah. Okay, here we go. We're going to begin with the text of the opening text of the Parsha. Parsha begins in chapter 9 of Leviticus. And then we're going to take a look at two of our greatest commentators, Rashi and the Ramban, Rashi and Nachmanides, who each have readings that I think will transform our understanding of what may appear at first to be a very technical ceremony. Okay, so here is your source sheet for today. And we'll take a look as we open on the eighth day. This is a big deal. They're starting the whole sacrificial system. This was the day. So here we are on the eighth day. Vayi bayom hashmini. It was on the eighth day. Kara Moshe la'aron ulavanav ulezikne Yisrael. Moshe called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. And oh my gosh, I'm like seeing a coyote walk right outside my house. Okay. You always got to mention wildlife, right? As we're thinking about animals here. So Moshe called Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel, and he said to Aaron, "Kach lecha egel ben bakar lechatat va'ayil le'ola t'mimim v'hakrev lifnei Hashem. Take yourself a calf from the herd for a sin offering." So here's the kinds of offerings. I was talking about categories of offering. One is a sin offering. And that's a chatat, chatat, from the language of sin, chet. Okay. A sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Ola, a burnt offering, because we call that because it all goes up. It all is consumed. So, like I said, we have talked a little bit, and I have written a little bit recently about what a sin offering might mean. That one, actually, we don't need me to write about. It means sin, right? You give a sinner offering when you have sinned. What do you give an olah? When do you give an olah offering? Well, we thought about that. Olah offering in Genesis was offered often after passing through a dangerous trial, like the binding of Isaac, after which Abraham gave an olah, or like Noah offering an olah after the flood. Okay, so that's looking at the categories of burnt offering and sin offering. That's one thing we can do. But what we're going to do today is ask, why a calf and why a ram? Okay, and this is the kind of work we can do throughout Leviticus, and speak to the Israelites saying, take a goat for a sin offering, and a calf and a lamb, yearlings, meaning 1 year old, without blemish for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for an offering of well-being to sacrifice before the Eternal, and a meal offering. Meal offering is the one that doesn't have any animals, it's just grain, with oil mixed in, for today the Eternal will appear to you. That's a big deal, okay? So we talked about this last week, the whole idea of sacrifices as a way of getting close to God. Okay, that's implied here. They brought to the front of the tent of meeting the things that Moshe had commanded, and the community leadership came forward and stood before the Eternal. And Moshe said, this is what the Eternal has commanded that you do, that the presence of the Eternal, the kavod of the Eternal may appear to you. And then Moshe said to Aaron, come close to the altar and sacrifice your sin offering and your burnt offering, making expiation for yourself and for the people, and sacrifice the people's offering and make expiation for them. Expiation is like a funny way of saying kapara, make forgiveness for them, kaper, like Yom Kippur. Okay. So Aaron came close to the offer and slaughtered his calf of the sin offering. And here, more detail. Aaron's sons brought the blood to him, and he dipped his finger in the blood and put it on the horns of the altar, and he poured out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar. There it is, Leviticus again, all graphic and gory and full of details. But let's just go back to the beginning here and start thinking about some of these animals. And we're not gonna do all of them, but we're gonna see how this works. Well, how our commentators make these links. So, and this is not going to be, this first one should be fairly easy to grasp, but what would you think? Why would Aaron be offering a calf as a sin offering? Okay. That's almost rhetorical, because if you've read the Torah before, you know what's coming. Why is Aaron offering an egel, a calf, as a sin offering? Somebody want to just like get the bonus point by saying it out loud?
For the golden calf.
There you go. Joe gets the bonus point. Right. The gold is the golden calf. The golden calf. That's important. That's an important backdrop to this whole scene, because Aaron, the first high priest of Israel, the brother of Moses, the central figure in this inauguration, is also someone who made the golden calf. He made the golden calf, not just participated in. He was the one that made the golden calf. And I realize I didn't put that on the screen, but let's just go see it, because that's what we're up to, right? We're looking at the Torah and trying to cross-reference a little bit. Let's go here to, what is it? Exodus 32, and see it happening. The people saw Moshe was long in coming down from the mountain, and they gathered against Aaron, or upon Aaron, and they said, make us a God who will go before us. Now, that seems like it's the people, you know, the Israelites, we're just terrible. We're always sinning. We're always looking for some kind of way to defy God. Oh, you know, terrible Israelites. But no, it's Aaron suddenly says, okay, take off the gold rings and bring them to me. And the people took off the gold rings, and he took it from them and cast it in a mold and made it into a molten calf. And you know, so Aaron built an altar for it, and he announced, tomorrow there's going to be a festival. We're going to dance around this calf. Okay. So Aaron did it. It is, and by the way, let's see. Moshe said to Aaron, what have you done? What did these people do to you that you've brought such a great sin upon them? Okay. So Aaron is culpable here in a way that is quite shocking. Like we never know quite what to do with the fact that Aaron seems entirely complicit, and not just complicit, but yes, he was approached at first, but very quickly he becomes the ringleader. Okay. So that's important just as narrative background. And then of course, Rashi picks up on and teaches us we should pick up on if Aaron is offering, for goodness sake, a calf, egel. As I always say, you don't need to know Hebrew, but you do need to just be able to identify a Hebrew word to appreciate the beauty of the Torah. So let's just identify that this word for calf is back in the Aaron story right here, the same word. Okay. So Rashi says, our sort of most, oh, sorry. I was deciding how much of this to add. So I had extra sources. Rashi says, Kach lecha egel. Kach lecha egel. Now, let's do a little bit of parshanut. Let's do a little bit of methodology. Why is Rashi jumping in to offer this commentary? We always say that Rashi is responding to some oddity in the verse. What is it in the words, take yourself a calf, that Rashi feels prompted to address? What's extra there? And I'm looking in the Jay says to everyone who Jay is, but an echo of lech lecha. That's good. That's good. That's right. Interesting to see it as an echo of lech lecha, like the earlier parsha where God said to Abraham, go yourself, which is a funny phrasing. So similarly here, kach lecha, take for yourself. And that wording is extra. Why not just take a calf? But no, take for yourself a calf. So just in terms of learning the way Rashi works, Rashi's not going to enter in and say something unless he has a justification. In other words, something in the verse seems a little extra much. There's something that's sticking out that needs addressing. And as far as Rashi is concerned, it's the take yourself. Of course, he's going to take it. Well, take it. It's extra. So what about Aaron? What about yourself, you, Aaron? Okay, and that's going to prompt Rashi to ask the question we've been asking. What is it about a calf? And this is like part one of our investigation, which is fairly intuitive. You got it yourselves, right? Or Jay got it. and I'm sure many of you were thinking, why take yourself a calf? To let him know, the Holy Blessed One would grant him atonement by means of this calf for the incident of the golden calf, which he had made. Okay. All right. So let's just pause there for a moment. I don't know if this requires a ton of analysis, but I just want to give us a sense of where we've arrived. Rashi says that, Rashi, our most famous commentator, says, oh, it's not a coincidence. It's not just the recipe for inauguration. Aaron has to take a sin offering, and the sin offering is an offering of a calf because Aaron sinned. Aaron sinned. And he didn't just sin randomly. He made a golden calf. So this is a symbol. This is a reminder that Aaron needs to atone for that sin before he can become the high priest. Okay. Now, that enough is like, we're 20 minutes into our class here, and that's good. We did the basic work. We can go home. Like that's good, important work, just as, again, as I keep saying, a matter of methodology. When we read Leviticus, we should be asking, why this animal? Why this animal? Now, I'll just pause for one more second before we take a look at the Ramban, who's our real star of the hour. But just to give you a sense of what else we might do, we're going to spend all our time on this calf. But, Aaron... Aaron is to take a sin offering of a calf because he sinned at the golden calf. The Israelites are taking a goat for a sin offering. Now, why would the Israelites take a goat for a sin offering? I don't know. Any thoughts? What do you think, Leah?
It's the goat that the sons of Jacob took, killed, dipped the blood in the Joseph's tunic, and we definitely have to pay for that.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. We don't know this, okay? We don't know any of this stuff, but we should be asking these questions. And what Leah just said is what the Maharal of Prague says, the Gur Arya, who has a commentary on Rashi, says exactly that. Oh, the calf is for Aaron. Aaron had to atone for the sin of golden calf because he did it. Yeah, all the Israelites were involved, but he did it. So why did the Israelites have to atone for the goat? Because the Israelites, meaning the tribes of Israel, who were originally 12 brothers, those brothers betrayed their brother Joseph and lied to their father by dipping his coat of many colors into goat's blood. So what Leah's done is exactly the kind of work that our commentators do. Oh, where have I seen a goat before? Is there some atonement that the Israelites would have to make? And now we have another great connection in thinking about the inauguration ceremony. We have to think, well, what are we still holding? You know, we're going to try to get close to God. We're going to try to make sacrifices. We still have a sin that has not been fully atoned because there was no method to atone for it, or because we haven't done the right inner work, whatever it is. You can start to see now how our commentators play with, oh, a goat for Israel, a calf for Aaron. Okay, good. So let's hear from Alan before we move to our next commentator.
Two things. I'm troubled because a chatat is when you do something or fail to do something bishgaga, not with unintentionally. The second point is, it sounds more like the asham, where there's a variable sacrifice with the leader having to bring a calf, and then it works down to the common people don't have to bring such a big thing.
That's true. That is true. So Alan is keeping us rigorous here and saying, wait a minute. That's not technically the category. It's nice to say it's a sin offering, Aaron sinned, but as we come to understand the sin offering, it is only given when you've sinned unknowingly, accidentally. And the reason for that is obvious. You can't have a system where it's just like you're allowed to sin and then wash it clean. You know, that would just be, you know, that's not a good way to encourage good behavior. So instead, our tradition comes to understand that a chatat is for unintentional sins. And Alan's right to then start investigating what's the difference between a chatat, a sin offering, and an asham, a guilt offering. And there are listings of when the communal leader or the priest has done something, they will offer a certain kind of, it doesn't seem to be fitting directly into these categories. And so, yes, Alan, Alan pushes back and we must concede this is not an exact science. We're hearing literary echoes here. Like Rashi wants to say, Aaron sinned, and this is a sin offering. And it does seem that Aaron, maybe we could speculate, was there something unintentional? Was it under duress? You know, we could speculate, but I actually think that a more honest answer is just to say, well, this is a little loose, but it's no coincidence that Aaron is being asked to offer a sin offering. And, you know, maybe the first sin offering is like unique in some way. We could speculate, but that's right. That's right. What we're looking for here is echoes rather than a precise legal account of what Aaron did. Okay, great. All right. So good work so far. And now I want to take us into a really a real masterpiece of Torah commentary by Nachmanides, the Ramban, Moshe ben Nachman, and one of the great sages of the medieval period, lived in Barcelona until the end of his life when he moved to Israel and wrote this commentary. And it's sort of generally acknowledged as one of the great masterpieces of Torah commentary. There's Rashi, who's the most famous. The Ibn Ezra, who Abraham Ibn Ezra, who was sort of the other great classic commentary in the medieval period. And then Nachmanides comes along and writes this commentary and sort of rounds out the top three, because everybody just acknowledges, though he wasn't, you know, in the generation of Rashi and Ibn Ezra, he's just done such a good job. Anyway, that's a little bit of an introduction to Nachmanides. Let's take a look at his commentary and see what he says. And we'll do the same thing here. Let's try to figure out what's bothering Nachmanides when he quotes the Torah. He's got some issue with the verses themselves, and he's not quoting the same verse. He is starting at the bottom of our passage. We said that Aaron was going to take all of this. And then at the end, Moshe said to Aaron, come close to the altar and sacrifice your sin offering and your burnt offering here. Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, krav el hamizbeach, v'aseh et chatatcha, v'et olatecha, v'chaper ba'adcha, uva'ad ha'am. Okay, so bring your sin offering, your burnt offering, make expiation for yourself, for the people, and sacrifice the people's offering and make expiation for them, as the Eternal has commanded. Vayikrav Aaron el hamizbeach. And so Aaron came close to the altar and slaughtered the calf of the sin offering. Vayikrivu b'nei Aaron et adam. And this is the translation I had here, but I just want to emphasize this, since Aaron's sons came close. Just so that we see how this language of coming close is repeated again and again and again. And they brought the blood to him, and he dipped his finger in the blood and put it on the horns of the altar. Okay, just to see this verb repeat and repeat will basically give us a sense of what the Ramban is doing here. Come close to the altar, he quotes, and Aaron came close to the altar and slew the calf, right? So what's sticking out to him here? What is methodologically, is he, I've basically already said it. You see the repetition of this word, come close, come close, come close, come close, come close. So already that is sort of a kind of signal that should alert us. But not only is it repeated a lot, which is interesting, but it is not necessary. You understand? Like, just tell him to perform the sacrifices and he will have to come close to the altar. So what is this like? No, come close. Come on. Okay? That repeated invitation to come close is part of what the Ramban here is tuning in on. And now we're going to take a little journey through his commentary, and he's got a lot to say. So let's take a look. So first of all, there's pshat, the simple explanation. And we won't spend much time on this, but it's good to just know that, you know, these commentators understood that the Torah was layered in meaning. And so there's a simple explanation, and then there could be a deeper explanation. So the simple explanation, the pshat, is that he was saying, come close to the north side of the altar and sacrifice the offerings, because they would do the sacrifices on the north side. But Moshe said it in a shorthand because Aaron already knew that. Okay. So you see, like, let's try to make sense of the technical meaning. Why did he say come close? Is he was saying, like, round here, they go this side. Maybe he had to say that, like, just to direct him. And it makes sense because that's the way they did the offerings. It's a simple answer. It does explain the verse. He says, though, Aaron already knew that. Why did he have to say it? You can see why he's not satisfied, but that's technically, you could offer a very basic answer. But that's not what we're here for today. Let's take a look at what he says after. Okay. What he says after is, and he starts quoting Midrashim. In Torah Kohanim, the standard Midrash on Leviticus, that's the Sifra. Now this is great language. Our rabbis took note of this problem, but in Hebrew, it's Nit'oru Raboteinu Bazeh. Our rabbis were awakened by this. They suddenly, whoa, look, take a look at this. They took note of this problem and they gave a parable. And this parable is just wild, folks. let's try to track it here. What is this like? It's like a king who marries a woman. Their parables, rabbis' parables in the Middle Ages were like all, they were just always kings. Or actually, this is before the Middle Ages in the Midrash. But it's always a king. And we can just guess who's the king in the parable. Like a king who marries a woman, but she's too shy to be with him, right? Think of your Game of Thrones kings, you know, it's like this like tender young maiden and she's totally terrified. So her sister comes in and says to her, why did you enter this arrangement if not to sleep with the king? Now, rouse yourself and go in and sleep with him. Okay? So did Moshe say to Aaron, my brother, why were you chosen to be the high priest if not to serve God? Rouse yourself and go perform your service. Okay. Now, this is like just fascinating. We need to do a little bit of work here trying to understand what this very, you know, not just patriarchal, but, you know, monarchical, like relational dynamic here. And who's who in the dynamic? I mean, I think that part I can just say, right? The king is always God. So king is God. Now, who is the young maiden betrothed to God? Presumably that's Aaron, right? And who's the sister who told Aaron to go in and sleep with the king? That's Moshe. And that's why Moshe is saying, come on, come sleep with God. It's like, what a weird thing to say. So let's just pause there. Does anyone have any thoughts on like, is this a good parable? Is there some depth? Does this make sense to you? Like, why use that analogy? First of all, why think of this as sex? You know, why put it in that language? And also, like, what is the motivation here? What is it that Aaron is too shy to get close to God, but Moshe says, yeah, you married God. Come on, go for it. So I want to just pause there and see if anyone sees some of the appropriateness or the inappropriateness or the depth of this midrash. Yeah, let's hear from Allison. We can't hear you yet. Oh, there you are.
Oh, hey. Excuse me, I'm out for a walk, but
yeah, it's very nice. It's a sunny day in Georgia. Yeah.
So this is interesting to me because I think like I've actually talked to you about this. I've been noticing these like very feminine qualities in Aaron. That's what you call him. I always say Aaron. but I've been noticing these very feminine and like in a troubling way, in like patriarchal feminine role ways, which I've never noticed in the text before this year, but all of a sudden this year I have noticed the ways in which Aaron is just kind of like expected to be of service all the time, and he doesn't really have his own voice or his own agency in any way, and there's kind of this expectation that, you know, like when Moses needs him, he'll be there. And like through his words, he will express like really the essence of what Moses means to say. Mm. And so Aaron becomes like by being Moses's voice and Moses's helper, Aaron also becomes like invisible sort of. And I think there's something in this story that we just read that like mimics that and almost like brings it to life in a way that hits you harder.
I love that. I love what you're saying because the implications are actually, or at least the implications are fairly wide reaching. Your analysis of Moshe and Aaron and God and their particular dynamic, I think, tracks well with this midrash. The sense that Aaron is the let's just like we're using but not affirming all of this patriarchal language here, but Aaron is the woman, the submissive, the server in this system, and that right, the way you said it is like Aaron, especially when contrasted to Moshe, becomes the beta, so to speak, in the relationship. Again, not affirming these things, but interesting to pick up on some of these dynamics, especially in this midrash where it's like a timid little maiden and the big powerful king. And that's interesting. What you said about Aaron being a servant and the way that that appears in some way, like maybe in our set of kind of associations as a feminine role. But it's especially interesting because the what happens as God becomes characterized as sort of male is that when we imagine some kind of relationship or partnership or love between God and the people of Israel, the people of Israel become female. This is something that we're not just speculating. This happens in the language of the prophets, and the prophet Hosea, for example. It's God is the maybe the king or maybe just the husband who has been betrayed by a, you know, unfaithful, loose moral like woman that is Israel. Now, okay, again, I'm a little even anxious speaking about women and men and men, you know, like we're in a different period now, but it is an important lens for us to think about. Oh, if God becomes a big powerful man in our metaphors, then, you know, then the rabbis are going to make the men in the story suddenly become women. And that's a very interesting dynamic just to hold in mind. Okay, let's, okay, great. Ready with psychological insight, I'll call on Jen Bailey-Guerra.
Yeah, I'm going to get really psychological here for a second.
Okay, good.
I mean, what we're describing is a flashback. That's exactly what we're describing here, right? And you have a flashback when trauma has happened to you.
Exactly.
And when trauma has happened to you, you often blame yourself and obsess over that trauma that has happened to you. And that doesn't mean that's valid, right? And I'm going back to that parable, which I cannot get out of my head, because it's a lie we all tell ourselves that the woman in that parable had agency, right? And everybody kind of knows, and they would have known, that there's not really agency there, but there is some. And did the people of Israel really have full agency at that moment of accepting accepting their relationship with God at that point? I don't think so. I think that took time. I think for them to really feel like this is like a Beauty and the Beast sort of theory of Israel's relationship with God, they weren't over that trauma. Aaron was not over that trauma. Aaron could not fully be present with God while that trauma was still in his heart. And so we can think of the covenant as being something that we actually took time to fully consent to, because it was friggin' terrifying, and you cannot make good choices when you're traumatized.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jen. I appreciate your voice always. And this is a good moment for Jen's voice, because we really need like a kind of a therapeutic eye on this, because that's right. Andy was right that the princess in the story has agency, or the queen-to-be in the story has agency, but really, like, again, imagine the Game of Thrones scene where it's like this terrified 17-year-old girl going into, like, the king, you know? How much agency is there? And that's a great thing to point out, because the parable is meant to evoke that. Aaron is, willing to do this, but completely terrified, both because of what he's done, but also just, like, what does this mean? I'm going to stand before the Almighty. I'm going to be the only person to go into the Holy of Holies. How do I take that on? It is paralyzing. Okay. And here I want to give you the next piece of the Ramban. It's just an amplification of what we've seen so far. Aaron is too terrified, but just, he adds that some would say that it wasn't just that Aaron was terrified and that he saw it in his mind, but some say it was the Satan who showed him this apparition, okay? And he has a source for that as well. But that's like a way of saying, it was like, you know, this is what it's like when we are tortured by our own past, by our own trauma, to use the word that Jen used. On the one hand, okay, work on it. You know, get over it, rouse yourself. And on the other hand, if you've been caught in that kind of dilemma, you don't feel like you have control. You feel like in the grip of your own shame and psyche and terror and social forces pressuring you, everybody watching. I mean, there's something, there's something paralyzed. Like Aaron is really in a kind of terrified panic here. Okay, let's hear from Stan.
Well, conversely, I'm thinking that perhaps Moshe is trying to teach Aaron a lesson. Moshe says, come over here, buddy boy. This is what a calf is all about. And not only I want you to slaughter it, I want to dip. I want you to dip your hand in the blood. I want you to realize you want to be forgiven for what you've done. I want you to realize that this is nothing but an animal that you can slaughter. That is certainly not representative of Hashem. And I don't think that Moshe was being that forgiving, considering what had transpired.
Okay, great. Thank you for that, Stan, for bringing us back into the scene, because this is just such a like arresting image of Aaron that I, you know, that alone is worth our time, and I wanted to kind of dwell in it. But okay, let's go back to the scene where Moshe is, despite all of that, saying to Aaron, come in, come in, come in. You think that you're beyond repair. You think you're so tarnished with sin. You've done the worst thing ever since, since they ate the apple. This is as bad as it gets. But no, come closer. Do it anyway. You have been chosen for this, even though you have a past. And there's something powerful about that. And I'll just give you, Stan's right on track here, because I'll give you the last piece. Now, this is how the Ramban ends his sort of woven various possibilities, the simple explanation, which was more logistics, the parable, which kind of brought us into the king's chamber, and then this really stunning psychological investigation and what's going on with Aaron. But then he ends with a kind of a lekach, a kind of a moral takeaway. And I find it very powerful. But that brings us back to what Moshe is saying. So let's just take a look here again. And this is the reason that it says at the end of the verse, and atone for yourself and for the people. Let me just show you that. Let me show you that. Take for yourself a calf and bring them before the Eternal. There it is. Come close to the altar and make expiation for yourself and for the people. You will be forgiven. This is not that's what I'm asking, is for you to make atonement. But just listen to this. The lesson here, as the Ramban understands it, is Moshe was telling Aaron to come close to the altar to offer all the sacrifices, but first do your own sin offering and burnt offering and atone for yourself first with your own sacrifices. And then afterwards, you will perform the offering for the people and atone for them for their sacrifice. Moshe was teaching Aaron that one must become innocent, or innocence, not really the word, like meritorious, cleansed, purged, in order to atone for the guilty. Okay. In other words, God knows what's up here. And Moshe knows what's up here. And yeah, he's got this, we've all got stuff hanging over our heads. And that's why Moshe's saying, yeah, make an atonement for that. And then once you've done it, you will become capable of doing it for others. Now, this is a really bold moral statement, because it's not just a technicality, like, oh, you're not allowed to sin if you've got like some marks on your record. It's deeper than that. It's like, you cannot help other people find atonement unless you know how to find atonement for yourself. Psychologically, that's true, because you will be a broken person. You cannot help them. But the deepest level is, you have to know what it's like to sin and to seek atonement and to feel ashamed. And Aaron had to know what it was like to sin in order to be the high priest. In other words, it's not disqualifying that he made the golden calf. It is that which qualifies him, because he too has sin. Remember what the Ramban said? He was a perfectly holy man, had never sinned once in his life. Do you want the high priest of Israel to be someone who has no idea what sin is like? I mean, that's a complicated question. Like, maybe you want him to be pure and perfect, but actually on a deeper level, don't you want the person who is negotiating your atonement to know what it's like to have to go inside and say, I really messed up. I really messed up, and I am going to try and fix it. And God makes that possible. And if he made it possible for me, the builder of the golden calf, surely he can make it possible for you. Okay. So that's sort of how the Ramban closes. So any final thoughts on that before we close? Okay. Okay, good. Then we'll leave it there with what we started with, which is like a really like deep understanding of how to identify animals and speculate on them. And we did it with the calf here, but we could do it as Leah did with goats and other things and rams. The ram should remind us of the ram at the binding of Isaac. So we'll keep our eye on animals, but also we've had an opportunity to really see one of our great commentators go deep, deep, deep into the psychology of one of the characters of the Torah. But I think also to go deep into just human psychology, to understand how we all struggle with this concept that we could carry around trauma and darkness and sin and nevertheless find expiation, find atonement. And that's part of what this sacrificial system promises, you know, despite what we're coming to the table with. So Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Good to see you all. I will see you next week.
Okay, that's it. A taste of our weekly Parsha class. I want to thank everyone who came to the class, some of whose voices you may have heard today, some you didn't because the podcast has been edited. So just want to thank everybody. And speaking of editing, I want to thank also our editor, Vera Blossom, for her great work. If you'd like to join our class sometime and come and join our circle of Torah geeks, you can find us again, Thursdays, 12 p.m., online at ikar.org. That's ikar.org. And if you go to the calendar, then you can find a Zoom link and just click in. And in the section on the website that we keep our classes, you can, if you click on Parsha Study, you'll find all of our archived classes and source sheets and everything we discuss there. So if you're looking for a regular Parsha class, I'd love to see you. And in the meantime, I will talk to you next week.